You know, I've often said that in the Hebraic movement, there's a bunch of rebels. And there are a bunch of rebels in this movement. And I believe that that's still a pretty fair assessment, because when you go from group to group to group, you know, there's always all this difficulty getting along with each other and all that. And most of it is because people felt like they were betrayed in their church before. They were taught something wrong, or they're abused in some ways, or their pastor wouldn't listen to them, or whatever. But there's a lot of people out there who believe that, you know, they just become rebels. And as a result of that, they become sort of anti-government, anti-authority. And it's in a way, that's good, because, you know, I'm sure all of us were part of a church that said we were the only church. And you have to be a part of our church to be saved. And I don't think I don't think any one group has a copyright on that phrase. But God never says you have to join anything, except that you join Israel. And you join in with his Torah and his walk. You don't have to join a church, an organization, or a sect in order to be a part of God's people. But does God say anything about authority outside of these organizations? Well, we know there's authority within the organizations. At least it was conveyed that way. But does he say anything outside of that? Is there any such thing as authority outside the organizations? Did the Israelites have the opportunity to set their own rules, to determine their own times, to establish their own priorities? No, they didn't. God laid it out. We saw it today in the Torah study, that God pretty much spells out the broad guidelines that he wants the people to follow. And then he set up the judges as a people to take and help sort of narrow that down a little bit. But even then, it was pretty much limited to that day and age. As one generation moved on, the next set of judges may determine differently, or a judge over here may determine differently than a judge over there, and it would apply differently to those different groups. God was very broad in that. As long as you basically follow the gist of the Torah, that's what God was for. But he was not in favor at all of anarchy. He was not at all in favor of the people just going and doing everything their own way. Because anarchy never does lead to peace, never does lead to people working together and getting together. And the Israelite people were people that were responsible for getting something done. Those of us today who have a problem with authority, and I'll say that I am one of the chief among them. I was one of the chief rebels. Jonathan was a rebel. Mark doesn't know he's a rebel, but he was a rebel. And those of us who are rebels, in most cases, we didn't rebel against the organization, or we didn't really rebel against authority. We were rebelling against the people who were in authority. And we were rebelling against the leadership of the groups. And in my case, I never really rebelled against somebody unless I knew them. And once I knew them, then I knew where they were coming from, and I knew the inner thoughts sometimes of what they were trying to do. And so I would get turned off to them, and I would rebel. I wasn't in a bad rebellion. I was just in sort of slight rebellion. But anyway, but when Messiah returns, are we going to rebel against him? Is he going to start telling us the way we believe the scripture means, or what that scripture means, is incorrect? And if he tells us that we're all wrong about, say, Sabbath, okay, that the Sabbath actually starts at morning time, which a lot of people believe, are we going to rebel against him because he says that? If once we're convinced that he is Messiah, are we going to be willing to rebel? Well, I would submit that even if he comes and tells us things that are contrary to the way we thought they were, that because of the way he works with us as a leader, we would not rebel. Because the difference between Yeshua and the rest of us is that he is the perfect leader. He is the one who knows how to lead in order to get the people to respond the way that they should respond. In the next few times that I have the opportunity to speak on things other than Galatians, I want to talk a little bit more about leadership. But we're going to start a short series on leadership, because leadership is something that's not spoken much about in the Hebraic movement. Basically because nobody wants to be a leader because no one's going to follow leaders anyway. We're all a bunch of rebels, remember? So what's the sense of being a leader if no one's going to follow you? So we're going to talk about leadership because there really does need to be leaders. If you don't have leaders, nothing gets done. And so we need to have leaders. So we're going to be talking about that in the next few sessions. But for right now, I want to touch on one of the many examples of leadership that's in the Scripture. And there are good examples of leadership, and there's bad examples of leadership. And in this particular teaching, I'm going to show us a bad example of leadership that happened about 2,000 years ago, and basically show you what may have caused these particular people to be bad leaders. And the people I'm talking about are the disciples of Yeshua, James and John. Now, many of us won't think of James and John as being bad leaders, but I'm going to show you that in their day, at least earlier in their day, they were indeed bad leaders. So, this is the story of James and John and their request for a high leadership position, even though they weren't deserving of it. You'll remember that in Matthew 20, there were two sons of Zebedee, there's James and John again, and their mother came up and was talking to Yeshua. Now, Yeshua was making his way down the Jordan Valley on the way to Jericho, and from Jericho he was heading up to Jerusalem, and this was going to be his last trip to Jerusalem. And so this puts the setting of this right around Passover. So it's pertinent for where we're at today. But he was headed up there, and they took a little break, I would assume, along the way to get refreshed. And he was traveling along with his entourage. And the wife of Zebedee, is what she's called, the wife of Zebedee, who is the mother of James and John, comes up to Yeshua and says, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one on your right hand and one on your left in your kingdom." And there's a parallel scripture to this. It's in Mark 10. Now, Yeshua's response was, "You don't know what you're asking." Now, he knew that on the end of this road, he was going to enter into Jerusalem, and that he would be facing a certain and grueling death. It was all part of God's plan. Yeshua knew that. But did they know that? Did they know what they were asking when they were asking to be a part of to sit on Messiah's right hand and the left hand? And so Yeshua asked them, are you able to endure what I'm getting ready to do? And their answer was, yes, we are able. And maybe they were. We don't know. You know, the text doesn't say that they were or they were not. He just asked the question and they just give the answer. We see no record in either case. What's more, they had just recently witnessed a remarkable vision. Wait a second, let me back up again. Back up here. One of the reasons they may have been able is that they had been taught by Yeshua numerous things about fear. And one of those is, do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both the soul and body in hell. Yeshua was getting ready to face death, but he knew how to approach it. He knew how to control the fear because he knew what the outcome was going to be. And maybe he had convinced his disciples of this at this point, that they would know how to handle the fear. And in addition to the teachings that he may have given them, these apostles, James and John, along with Peter, had just witnessed Messiah on top of a mountain talking with Moses and Elijah. So, at least in a vision. And so they understood this, and James and John had this keen insight of something that the others probably weren't able to have. And so maybe, yes, maybe they were ready to face the same situations that Yeshua was going to sit. But did that give them the qualifications to sit on the right hand and the left hand of the Messiah? Janice is shaking her head no. All right. So who are these guys? And we'll answer that question a little bit later. Who are these guys, James and John? All right. James and John were the first disciples, along with Peter and Andrew, who were called. You remember the story? They were Yeshua was walking there along the shores of Galilee, and there was this big entourage with him, and they were pressing against him, and he needed to get away. He wanted to speak to him, but he couldn't speak to everybody because they were just crowding around him. So he came upon Peter and Andrew, and they were mending their nets or cleaning their nets, and Yeshua says, "Hey, can I get in your boat and you guys take me out a little ways?" And he does. They agree that he takes them out on the boat just a little ways. And Yeshua then, from a few yards out, was able to teach the people. But after he got through teaching the people, he goes to Andrew, to Peter and Andrew, and says, "You guys go out some more and cast your nets out." And Peter says, "Well, you know, we've been fishing all morning. There's no way we're going to catch any fish out here." But Yeshua insists, and so they go ahead and cast their nets out. And, of course, their nets are very full. And so their nets are so full, there's too many fish to put in their boat. So they holler at their partners. The scripture says their partners, who are James and John and their father Zebedee, who's in a boat nearby, and summons them to come over, and they put the rest of the fish in that boat. So here James and John, Peter and Andrew, and Zebedee, their father, has seen this miraculous miracle, and obviously this had a big impact on them. And so these guys left their fishing business, all of them except for Zebedee himself. They all left their fishing business and began to follow Yeshua. Now, this was more than likely not their first. In fact, we know it's not their first encounter with Yeshua. I would suspect that they probably all grew up together. Yeshua, James, John, Peter, and Andrew. I think they were all good buddies all along myself, because they were so willing to follow him. They were just willing to jump right out after him. And we know, for instance, that Peter was a married man, and Peter's mother-in-law was sick. And one day, it was actually one Sabbath, Yeshua, James, John, Peter, and Andrew were all at the synagogue together. And afterwards, Peter invited them all over to his house for a big after-Sabbath oneg. And so they came over, and Peter said, "Oh, by the way, Yeshua, my mother-in-law is feeling a little bit sick. Can you do something about it?" And he goes over and takes care of it. It's sort of like a matter-of-fact thing, you know. Would you take care of it? And so Yeshua does. And after that, the word gets out, and now there's throngs of people outside to take care of that. So they're the first disciples, and they immediately left the fishing business to follow him. And I suspect the reason why they did so is because they knew the guy pretty well. And now they saw these miracles he was able to do, and they were quite convinced. Another thing about James and John is they were probably priests. We know from the story and the account of John about the crucifixion that John was allowed to come to the inner portion of the home of the priest, of the high priest. And so, in fact, he makes a very big deal about it. He talks about it twice, John does, and says that, you know, the disciple that Jesus loved and all this was able to go in and all that. You've all read the story, so I'm just paraphrasing. You know what I'm talking about, right? Okay. So because he was allowed to go in, many suspect that he was a priest. And if he was a priest, if Zebedee was a priest, James, and if John was a priest, then James was a priest because they're brothers. And so as priests, these guys probably had a more defined knowledge of the Torah than did rest of the Israelites, or rest of the disciples. And they also probably had a more defined understanding of the temple services than did the other disciples. And therefore, when Yeshua talked about things regarding the kingdom and all that, many of which related to the temple, then these guys knew a little bit more how to relate to Yeshua. So being priest was a possibility, but we don't know necessarily the case. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to define James and John, so we'll know a little bit about their background, why they asked what they did ask. And then another thing about James and John is that along with Peter, they're the most mentioned disciples of all the disciples. You don't read much about the other guys, but you read a lot about Peter, James, and John. Peter, James, and John were the only ones that witnessed the transfiguration. They're the only ones that Yeshua took up on the mountain with them. Peter, James, and John were the only disciples at the healing of Jairus' daughter. You remember, she's a little girl that they came in and they're all weeping, and he went in there and raised her all up, you know? James, Peter, and John were there. They were the only ones that accompanied Yeshua when he prayed at Gethsemane. The rest of the disciples stayed further down the mountain. But Yeshua called James, Peter, James, and John to go up here to the top. And they were, he said for them to specifically watch for him, remember? That was Peter, James, and John. Peter, James, and John, along with Andrew, were the ones that asked Yeshua about the end times. They're in Matthew 24. They were the ones that wanted to know the intimate details about his coming, what was going to happen when he arrived, and all of that stuff. And of course, John himself described himself as the disciple that Jesus loved. So Peter, James, and John were part of an inner circle, Yeshua's inner circle. They were the ones that I would suspect that Yeshua was able to talk in much deeper thought than the others. And so, because of that, this may have been one of the reasons why James and John requested that they sit at his right hand and his left hand. But we, of course, we know what Yeshua said. James and John, though, had a peculiar character flaw. Actually, it wasn't too peculiar because a lot of us have it. James and John were called the sons of thunder. Remember that? All right. The Greek word is boanerges, or something like that. And according to Mark, who records this, it meant sons of thunder. But there's a lot of commentaries who question that because the Greek doesn't add up to sons of thunder. And then there's those who have tried to take it back through the Septuagint and go back to see what this word would have meant in the Septuagint. But it doesn't exist in the Septuagint, so it's hard to do. But one of the common beliefs about this, and in fact it's in Strong's Concordance, is that the word Boanerges actually means raging bull. Raging bull. And I believe that that's probably correct. Because in some cases that we have recorded for us, James and John acted like raging bulls. And we're going to look at those here real quick. Raging bulls. There we are. As we remember, when James and John were called to be disciples, they had a lot of zeal. They just, when Yeshua said, come, they came. They had a lot of zeal for Yeshua, probably because they had known him before. But as they saw Yeshua start to display the various miracles he was able to display, and because the people in his day, or in their day, believed that the coming of the Messiah was imminent, and with the coming of Messiah would also come the restoration of the kingdom of Israel, these guys were filled with more and more zeal. And as they continued to draw close to Yeshua, and as they continued to see the crowds that were surrounding him and the words that were flowing out of his mouth and the many miracles that were coming as a result of the healings and all that stuff, or which resulted in healings and stuff, they grew more and more confident that the end of the age was right there at hand. Yeshua, though, tried to temper their zeal with the reality that things were not going to happen quite as quickly as possible, as they had thought. But nevertheless, it seems like James and John seemed to build a cocoon around Yeshua. They seemed to take and have this feeling that we really need to protect this guy. We need to protect his integrity. And so they became more and more loyal to Yeshua. And we see that in a couple of things that they did. First off, John specifically, John was had observed a group of people who were casting out demons in Yeshua's name. Remember that story? Okay. And he said he says that he forbid them to do it. He goes to Yeshua and says, I forbid them from taking and casting out demons in Yeshua's name. Well, why shouldn't they cast out demons in Yeshua's name? If these guys had enough faith to cast out demons, what was wrong with them casting out demons in Yeshua's name? They obviously believed that Yeshua was Messiah. But the problem was they were not a part of Yeshua's group. They didn't belong to that little inner circle of people that followed Yeshua around. And so John got concerned about that, and he brought it to Yeshua's attention, of course. Yeshua told him that if they're not against us, they're for us. And they certainly weren't against him. So it sort of forced John to have to open it up a little bit. He had to share Yeshua with other people, okay? But John didn't like doing that. And then there is another example. And this example actually took place on the same trip that we started talking about at the beginning. And this is when Yeshua was going down to Jerusalem, or going up to Jerusalem, to face his crucifixion. And on the way, they came upon this Samaritan village. Now, remember, Yeshua had gone to the Samaritans once before and talked to the Samaritan woman, remember? And as a result of this discussion with the Samaritan woman, the Samaritan men came out and had some discussion with Yeshua and actually invited Yeshua to stay with them for 2 days. And he did. And he came and spoke for 2 days. But as they were coming upon this Samaritan village this time, they're headed into the village, and Yeshua sent a couple of the disciples ahead of him and said, hey, you guys secure a lodging for us for the evening. And so they went and they talked to the people who were supposed to get lodging from. And remember, Yeshua, when he sent his disciples out, said that, you know, if they don't accept you when you come in, you dust off your feet and move on. But it's interesting about the text, what it says. The Samaritans didn't want Yeshua to stay there that night. At least they didn't invite him in to stay for free, okay? But Yeshua says, or the text says, the reason they didn't do so was because his face was set for Jerusalem. In other words, he was in a hurry. He just wanted to get a good sleep, and he wanted to move on. The Samaritans wanted him to come in and teach, talk, preach, okay? He didn't have time for that. And so the text says, because his face was set for Jerusalem is why they didn't accept him. So they just went down to another little town and got a place to stay down there. But James and John didn't like that. They thought that they had insulted Yeshua by not accepting him and having them stay there. And so they went to Yeshua and said, let us call down fire from heaven just like Elijah did and destroy this whole city. They had a zeal for Yeshua, but it wasn't according to knowledge, because if they had just thought, the Samaritans had been very open to Yeshua, more so than the rest of the Jews, why would they want to call fire down and destroy this people simply because they said, hey, man, if you don't want to stay here and speak for a while, we need you to go on, you know? But nevertheless, that's what they said. And this is what Yeshua said when they said that. Do you not know what manner of spirit you are of? For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. So Yeshua is quite upset with them. It says that he rebuked them. Actually, in many texts, this passage is not in there. Just the fact that he rebuked them is in. But I put it in here because it does make a pretty good point. So the flaw that James and John had was that they were eaten up with zeal for Yeshua, but they had no zeal for anybody else. They didn't have it for this group of people who were casting out demons in Yeshua's name, and obviously more successful in many cases than they were in doing so. Remember, the disciples had problems casting out demons. Okay? They didn't have much zeal and they didn't have much concern or much loyalty for the Samaritans who had reached out to Yeshua in the past, but simply because Yeshua didn't want to stay the night, they said, well, you know, we can't put you up for the night. They didn't have much loyalty for these people. They had zeal for Yeshua. They had zeal for Yeshua's mission, but it was not tempered with justice, mercy, and faith. And that is the problem they had. So thus, when the mother of their mother, Zebedee's wife, made the request, which it seems was on their behalf, seems like these guys were actually wanting, say, they told mommy to go ask on their behalf, Yeshua used it as an opportunity to teach about leadership. And he said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave. Even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. These guys knew what Yeshua was saying. They were living under Roman occupation, and they understood what it meant to be under occupation. When the Romans went into a nation, they didn't go in there and say, hey, what can we do for you guys? They went in, they conquered the nation, they forced the nations to take and submit to their gods. Rome had a special situation with the Jews. Many of you know about that. But for the most nations, when the Romans went in, they conquered, destroyed, ruled by intimidation or by threat of murder or death. And so they knew that. The disciples knew that very well. And what Yeshua was telling them is that you guys, you're acting like the Romans. You're acting like people that if they're not a part of us, then you're ready to just destroy them. Which is exactly what the kind of message that these guys were showing. What Yeshua wanted them to see is that leaders in the kingdom cannot be arrogant, they cannot be oppressive, but would have to be as servants, helping the people see the value of walking God's way. But where did James and John get this idea from? Why did they associate the kingdom coming, their zeal for Yeshua, and the belief that they should sit on the right hand and the left hand of Messiah? Is there anything in the scripture that would lead them to thinking that their zeal should give them that authority or that responsibility? And I say, yes, there is. And we're going to look at that. But first, let's lay a little bit of background. In the first century, as I mentioned before, the people were in great expectation of a Messiah coming. And along with the coming of the Messiah would mean the restoration of the kingdom of Israel. They were looking forward to the kingdom of Israel being restored to the way it was before it was split after King Solomon's death. And they knew that Yeshua was going to sit on his father's throne, basically on the throne of David. And just as David had leaders who sat on his right hand and his left hand, it would be appropriate for Yeshua to have the same. And so who were the leaders? Now, I'm not saying that there was leaders that were said that they sat on the right hand and the left hand. But David had leaders who were his key people. James and John wanted to be the key people. They wanted to be on the right hand and left hand Messiah. They wanted to be like someone who was in King David's court. And that person, I submit, is David's nephew, Joab. Okay? Okay, Joab was, of course, he was David's nephew. He was the son of David's sister. I think her name is Zeruah. Joab had a couple of brothers. Their names were Azahel and Ibishai. And these guys are important in understanding the story of Joab. And Joab became the commander of the army of Israel. And this is how it happened. David had just become king over all Israel, and he was ready to take Jerusalem. And he says, "Whoever strikes the Jebusites first shall be chief and commander." And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first, so he became chief. And David lived in the stronghold. Therefore, it was called the City of David. And he built the city all around from the Milo in complete circuit. And Joab repaired the rest of the city. So Joab, because David asked, who will take the Jebusites, who will be first to attack the Jebusites? Joab didn't even miss a beat. He just jumped right out there and said, I'll do it. And he just went and attacked. And because of Joab's doing so, he became the captain of the whole army of Israel. Joab was fearless. He became the commander of the army of Israel, and he also was a fearless man. When the opportunity came, he stepped out in zeal. He didn't hesitate. He didn't wait for others. He just acted. He and his brother Abishai, up here, were completely devoted to David. Once when fighting the Ammonites, Joab was about ready to take the city. He cut off the water supply to the city. And Joab could have gone ahead and gone in there and taken the city for himself. And it says, though, that if Joab had done so, then his name would have been on the city. In other words, people would have remembered the conquest of Ammon as the defeat of Joab. But what Joab did, because of his loyalty to David, after he took the water supply and after he knew that it was just a matter of a couple of days that he would take it to the city itself, he sent messengers back to David and said, David, bring your people with you. You come and you lead the army so that when the city is taken, it'll be taken in your name, not in mine. So Joab, he was very humble in that regard. Anytime it came to David, very loyal to David. If you remember the case of Shimei after Absalom had his rebellion, and Shimei was cursing David as he's walking down the way, it was Joab's brother Abishai who went to David and said, David, let me kill this guy because he's cursing you. In other words, he's defaming you. He's not preserving your dignity. He's not treating you as king. So Abishai was willing to go out and just kill this guy to protect David's dignity. And then there was the case of Joab when David wanted to number Israel. And Joab went and confronted David and said, David, you can't do this. Well, Joab could have been killed for that, for confronting the king. But yet he still stuck his neck out. He was still willing to take and confront David in order to preserve David's dignity and his name. But of course, we know that David didn't listen to Joab, and ultimately he did number Israel. But even though Joab was so dedicated to David, Joab caused David a number of problems. On two different occasions, Joab killed people who David had made covenants with, or David had extended out the hand of peace to. So, I want to put this up here because we need to understand what was going on right after King Saul died. When King Saul died, his son Ishbosheth became king. But he became king over Israel, not over Judah. The nation basically went through a little split. Okay? Actually, they were never really united that much anyway before that. But in fact, we read in the Parashah today. Or not in the Parashah, but in the in 1 Samuel 10, 11. There was an army of Judah and there was an army of Israel that was raised up when Saul became king. So The kingdom of Israel was separate from Judah. Ishbosheth was king, and Ishbosheth made Abner his general. And Abner was the general of King Saul's army as well. And Abner was also a close friend of David. Abner, in fact, helped David out of a number of fixes where he could have got himself killed from Saul. So Abner was pretty important to David. And then there was the kingdom of Judah, which, of course, David was king, and Joab was the general. Now, this is before the nations actually united, but Joab was still the general over Judah, the army of Judah at that time. Soon war broke out between Israel and Judah, and they were fighting, and it seemed like there was this constant war going on. So after a number of years, Abner, the general from the kingdom of Israel, went down to David and said, "David, I've had enough." Basically, he was already saying, I'm paraphrasing, "I've had enough of this fighting." He said, "Ishbosheth is losing influence over Israel. I've talked to the leaders of Israel, the elders of Israel, and they're all willing to come and anoint you king over Israel as well." And David said, "That's great." And so David agreed to that. They entered into a covenant, it says, and thus they were bound to each other. So here they are. There's this a commitment of peace there between the two of them. And Abner heads off. He goes back up to Israel. He was going to tell the elders that we've made a deal and that David's going to be our king. But on his way up to Israel, Joab hears about it. He hears that Abner had been down and visited David and that they had made a peace agreement. Now, Joab was very loyal to David, but he wasn't very loyal to Abner. And with Abner, the general over Israel, bringing all Israel under David's leadership, it would be very likely that Abner may become the captain of the army of all Israel. But of course, that's not the way it worked out, because we know how David actually chose the captain of all Israel. So anyway, Abner was headed up north. Joab found out that Abner had been to Jerusalem, had made this deal with David. And so Joab works it out to where Abner is summoned back down to Hebron, where David was. And when he gets down there, Joab kills Abner. So he's killed this man who David is in covenant with. Now, that's an important thing, because David was responsible, basically, for Abner's protection. And so Joab really caused a big problem. Now, there's another case, and this was Absalom's rebellion. In this situation, there's a kingdom of Israel. Absalom becomes king, and Amasa becomes the general. All right? When Absalom rebelled, all of Israel and most of Judah followed Absalom, and they anointed Absalom king over all Israel. So thus, David became a deposed king, but because he still had an influence, there was a number of people who followed him, and Joab was still the general. So Joab stayed loyal to King David, even though most everybody, all the northern tribes of Israel and most of Judah had gone to follow David. Joab still remained loyal to King David. But as time went on, we know that that Absalom became stronger and stronger and stronger, and David was banished out of Jerusalem. Absalom makes as his king or his general this guy Amasa. And then there's this war, and David goes down and they fight against Absalom. Absalom gets his hair caught in a tree, and Joab comes and kills Absalom. Right? And at the death of Absalom, the rebellion is over with, and now the northern tribes and the southern tribes start coming together. But there was a problem. The northern tribes came and asked David to be their king first before Judah asked David to be king. But yet Judah took and tried to take an upper hand, and when David was wanting to cross, or he was going to cross the Jordan, which is a significant thing because crossing the Jordan means that you've come back into the land. The Jews, the people from Judah work it out to where David crosses earlier. The Israelites, the northern kingdom was not there. And so they steal this opportunity from the northern kingdom. And as a result of that, the northern kingdom rebels again. And they depart and say, well, we're not going to have David as our king. All right, so David's got a little problem. And so David's fix for the problem was that he made Amasa the general over the army of Israel instead of Joab. All right. Joab had remained faithful to David, but David needed a political tool to use, and what he did is he used Amasa as the tool. And he made an agreement with Amasa, and he says, you know, you're my general, thus, you know, the king of the army has to protect his soldiers. And so David is responsible for the safety of Amasa. But very soon there was this rebellion that was going on in the north. David tried to put the rebellion out. And so he sent Amasa and the army of Israel up to fight. And along with that went Joab. But Amasa doesn't go as quickly as David tells him to go. And ultimately what happens is this. Joab gets frustrated and he kills Amasa. So now, here's Amasa dead. Now, Amasa, just by the way, happens to be David's nephew as well. They're cousins. I mean, Joab and Amasa are cousins, right? So what we see is this. David's right-hand man remained loyal to David, but he killed two men whom David had extended the hand of peace and mercy to. And that was Abner and Amasa. Though he was fiercely loyal to David, he was not loyal at all to David's subjects, to the people David was responsible for. Just before David died, he gave final instructions to Solomon, his son, who of course was the new king. And he told him a number of things, but the first thing he told him was to always be loyal to the Torah. Always walk in Torah. And if you'll walk in Torah, all will be well and you'll prosper. But the next thing he told him, the very next thing he told them, was this. Moreover, you also know what Joab the son of Zeruiah did to me. How he dealt with the two commanders of the armies of Israel, Abner the son of Ner and Amasa the son of Jether, whom he killed, avenging in the time of peace for blood that had been shed in war, and putting the blood of war on the belt around his waist and on the sandals of his feet. David considered what Joab had done as sins against David. By Joab not being loyal to David's subjects, Joab showed himself actually to be unfit to be the commander of the army of Israel. Of course, David didn't deal with this in his lifetime. He left it up to Solomon to take care of. He told Solomon to act, therefore, according to your wisdom, but do not let his or Joab's gray head go down to hell in peace. And after David died, Solomon instructed Benaiah, the new commander of the army of Israel, to have Joab put to death. And in his instructions to Benaiah, Solomon said, the Lord will bring back his bloody deeds on his own head, Joab's, because without the knowledge of my father David, he attacked and killed with the sword two men more righteous and better than himself. Abner, the son of Ner, commander of the army of Israel, and Amasa, the son of Jether, commander of the army of Judah. So these two commanders, even though at one time both of them had been enemies of David, were considered more righteous than was Joab, David's trusted friend. So what's the lesson that we can learn from this? It's quite simple. Loyalty to the king, if it doesn't extend to the king's subjects, is not loyalty at all. And that was the problem with James and John. James and John were loyal. They were fiercely loyal to Yeshua, but they had little regard for Yeshua's subjects, for the people that Yeshua was working with, for the people who had become loyal themselves to Yeshua. If they weren't a part of this little clique of theirs, then they had little regards for them. So they showed themselves, James and John showed themselves to be unfit to be leaders in the kingdom of God, the kingdom of Israel. Of course, that's not the end of the story. We know that Yeshua continued that trip down to Jericho, and he made his way up to Jerusalem. Within a few days or a few weeks, he was dead. And then shortly after that, he was resurrected. And James and Peter and John were all witnesses to that. And this changed their lives. And as a result of that, these guys became, according to Paul, pillars in the church, or pillars in the Messianic Hebraic movement. And in fact, James was the first of the disciples to be martyred. And we know that John went on to write chapters and chapters about love and loving your fellow man and looking out for your brother. So we know that these guys had a change of heart down the road. Leadership, especially leadership in the body of Messiah, requires loyalty not only to God but to those with whom God is working. We can't decide for ourselves whether or not we want to honor our brothers. We just have to do so. Because if God is working with them, and if they're walking in God's ways, and if God is honoring them, then we have to honor them as well. So we'll continue this study, and we're going to look at more cases of leadership and more. We'll talk about more examples and how we can become better leaders and why we need to become leaders. But for now, I'll just say Shalom Aleichem. Peace be unto you. And I hope that we learned a little bit from this study today.